guest artist is Pat Metheny, who's here right now in the studio, and I want to welcome you. Thanks for coming up, Pat.
Great to be here.
Great to see you, and I've heard you many times, of course, and over the years, and listened to many recordings, and have enjoyed them a lot, as well as I know many of our listeners, and it meant a lot to a lot of us. I've played with guitarists that have been Metheny freaks and would pull out this and that tune and try to imitate some of a signature sound that they imagined that you have. But that's actually one of the first things I want to talk about. I think not just guitarists, but any musician would do well to think kind of long and hard about sound production and a tone that is distinctively theirs, a voice of their own. And I think you stand out as one of the guitarists who certainly do that. You have a very distinctive sound that you'd recognize in just moments, even though over the years I've noticed quite a development, evolution of that sound, different things of using different kind of guitars with different numbers of strings and different kinds of sound reinforcement and amplification of some of the usual tricks, but different things too, very, very distinctive ones. But what I want to hear what you have to say. I'd like you to elaborate on tone production and what that's been for you.
It's an interesting area, and thanks for noting that quality. To me, that was always sort of a central piece when I looked across the spectrum at not just my favorite guitar players, but my favorite musicians. They all seem to have some kind of a fingerprint, some kind of a thing. Like, I mean, you say the name Miles Davis or
sure, that
Joe Henderson
those
or
both, yeah.
Gary Burton. I mean, mm-hmm. It's like you almost say somebody's name and you get this sort of sonic
mm-hmm. a sound.
Identity mm-hmm. somehow. You just get it right away. I mean, for me, there's a couple different ways to look at it. To me, it's more a conceptual thing than it is a physical thing. Maybe my favorite guitarist is Wes Montgomery. I mean, mm-hmm. I made no secret that he's the guy for me mm-hmm. over the years. And like many young players, when I first started playing, he was my model. I played mm-hmm. with my thumb. I mm-hmm. did everything I could do to try to sound mm-hmm. like Wes. And fortunately, I was around older musicians who kind of took a dim view of that rather than mm-hmm. encouraging that, sort of with the idea of like, this guy's already doing that. Mm-hmm. Why not try to
do your own thing?
Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
I kind of realized early on, it's sort of like, I kind of wanted to do what he did, not what he did. Meaning, mm-hmm. It's like he
come up
found,
with his own sound instead
he found
of
a way of
imitate.
Making his identity mm-hmm. clear in every note mm-hmm. somehow
sure.
or another.
Yeah.
And, using Wes as an example, I mean, the guy used all kinds of different guitars, different sounds, different amps, different, sometimes you hear some of those early records and it's clearly a, solid body, with the middle pickup on. And then, of course, later on, it was the more jazz guitar, humbucker type sound. And it sort of doesn't matter at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like the identity was before the instrument. And,
sure.
I started out as a trumpet player. I write almost everything on piano.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, guitar is my, main voice, I guess. But when I have an idea, I mean, I still play enough trumpet and I can play the piano, because it's pretty easy compared to other instruments. The idea that I play is the same regardless.
Mm-hmm, sure.
It's not really attached to an instrument. And that's sort of true regarding the different types of guitars and sounds mm-hmm. that you were talking about. I mean, to me, I always try to use guitar kind of almost in terms of orchestration. I try to find a sound that fits an idea best as opposed to the other way around. Like, I have a sound, what am I going to play with that sound? And, when I think about, again, my major heroes in music, that seems to be more consistent to me, that the idea is sort of precedes the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And the instrument is truly an instrument, a way of manifesting that idea or that sound, into life so that mm-hmm. other people can hear it.
Well, I like what you're saying. We have a fellow here from Sandpoint, Leon Atkinson, that does a guitar hour with Vern in the morning. It's classical guitar oriented and all, but I shouldn't be doing this. I'm indulge me for a second. As I walk by, sometimes we'll make smart alecky comments as I walk by and hear him say a thing. And he said, now what, he was giving a trick question, trying to get people to call in to win a CD or something. And what part of the body produces the tone on a guitar? And as I walked by, I said, the brain. I knew he was, you know, he was going for the fingernails, you know, but
that's a good one.
But I think it's a little bit like what you were talking about. Well, let's talk some about the concert tomorrow night with the Whitworth Jazz Ensemble, and you'll be playing with as a solo instrumentalist, but not with your band. It's you and the jazz ensemble.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I've never really done before, actually.
That's exciting.
You think it would have come up at some point along the way. My good friend and playing partner, Chris Potter, who last time I was here in town, Chris was playing with me, and he gave me kind of a stellar recommendation of, coming out here and playing with the band, and had nothing but great things to say about his experience, and I was very happy to get the invitation to come. And this is an odd period for me. This is really the first chunk of time I've taken off from having a band out on the road since 1994. It's really been a continuous, like last year we did almost 160 concerts around the world, and the year before that 100 and some. I mean, it's I'm lucky to say it's been that way for most of my life. And kind of got to a point where I really kind of said I need to take a little bit of time off and just kind of get caught up with things. So I've been doing a number of unusual things this year, different from what I normally do. I wrote a big band piece for this Eberhard Weber tribute, which is something, again, I don't think I'd written a big band chart since about, you know, eighth grade or something like that. So that was really fun, and did that around the world in a few different places. And I was the artist in residence at the Detroit Jazz Festival this year. Again, something I rarely get to do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So this kind of fit in with that. It was like, okay, well, you know, this opportunity came up, and I'm very excited to see what it'll be like. And I'm sure it's going to be a rewarding experience for me.
That's great. This is really cool that at this stage you're doing something entirely different. That's kind of fun and exciting for you, and I'm sure for everybody that's going to listen to it. Now, what are some of the tunes that are going to be on it? I know you do a lot of composing. Are there some that are yours?
There are a number of charts that have been written over the years, by different people. One of the gentlemen who's really done a lot of work is a guy from this area, Bob Curnow. When this all first came up that he wanted to do charts on some of my tunes, I was like, okay. But I didn't really realize the extent that it was going to introduce a lot of young musicians around the world to my thing. And I mean, I'm constantly meeting kids we played, Always and Forever on our concert this year, and all the others. I don't even know how many he's done at this point, but it must be 20 or 30. We're going to play a couple of his charts on my tunes. Have You Heard, Always and Forever, It's Just Talk. Uh-huh. And we're also going to play a couple standards, which that's kind of the foundation, I guess, for me. And, you know, it's like I kind of came up through the Kansas City ranks playing those tunes, and we're going to do a blues in there, too. So it'll be a nice little mix of things.
Well, there's a lot to be said for both. I think it's important for musicians to compose. But on the other hand, when as a listener listening to various artists, you sometimes know a little bit more what to make of it if you hear that an artist interpret a standard, something that you're familiar with, something you've got a common ground with, so that you can tell where what somebody's doing with that, because it's harder to know what they're doing with their own composition, whether they're really improvising there or if it's a. Over the years, you gather a sense of it. You know, some of your compositions have shown up on various albums, and you hear it done several ways, and so it becomes a standard of its own. In fact, some of your songs, I think, really have become standards as a result of that.
It's funny for me. I mean, the whole thing of, being a composer, evolved because there was a way I wanted to play as an improviser that I was increasingly finding elusive when I was playing on a standard or on a Wayne Shorter tune or something like that. There was a certain kind of just harmonic and, you know, just sort of sensibility that when I wrote my first tune and I gave it to the guys and said, okay, you play this and you play this and you play this, it was sort of like, well, not only could I then improvise the way that I, you know, had hoped I would be able to get to, but also it was, I discovered it was a way of sort of creating a contextual environment to be a musician mm-hmm. in. And, you know, it's sort of exploded from there. I mean, at this point, I think I've had 500 or 600 tunes recorded, and in many ways it's taken over as the sort of dominant you know, activity for me, mm-hmm. you know, and it overlaps with band leading and all that, and guitar playing and being an improviser certainly a part of all that, but you know, there was a time it was the thing, and now it's just, you know, those things of just being a player are part of the thing, and you know, that's been an interesting development over the course of these, you know, mm-hmm. decades I've been doing this.
Well, it sounds to me like you're still evolving as an instrumental, as a guitar player. Does it seem that way to you, that you're a real different player than you were 20 years ago?
Well, you know, when I first started making records, Bright Size Life, I'd only been playing for, you know, 4 or 5 years, you know, and now I've been playing, you know, 50 sure. years. Yeah. So, or it's, you know, roughly, you know, those numbers. But, you know, the thing about playing for me is that I don't ever really feel like I'm playing. I feel like more like I'm listening.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah, well.
And while I'm listening, I think, okay, if there was a guitar player playing, which there is, and that's me, what would I want that guy to play?
Sure, sure.
And then I try to play that. So, mm-hmm. you know, I've never felt a particular affinity to the guitar as a guitar, mm-hmm. you know, it's just a translation device mm-hmm. for me. And, you know, the downside of that is that I play the instrument, as I've been told many times, in a very odd kind of way. It's not real technically right in a way. I just try to get the mm-hmm. sound out.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I have also kind of embraced the range of things that a guitar can be. I mean, it is an odd instrument in the sense that if you say the word guitar to 50 people, mm-hmm. they're going to get 50 different
sure.
ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You can see these 50 little bulbs over mm-hmm. their heads, and for mm-hmm. one guy it's Segovia, and mm-hmm. for another guy mm-hmm. it's Megadeth, and for another guy it's Derek Bailey. You know, I mean, it's like everybody mm-hmm. guitar is something different. Well, if you mm-hmm. say saxophone, there's a range, but it sort of clusters around a sonic thing that we would all mm-hmm. quickly identify mm-hmm. as saxophone. I've kind of embraced that part of what guitar can be because I don't care that much about guitar in a way. It's just this thing. And at the same time, it's an incredibly flexible, variable, malleable thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, maybe goes to the thing you were talking about earlier on about the different sounds and different types of guitars and all
mm-hmm.
that. However, for this concert, I brought one guitar. I'm going to plug it into one amp, and I'm going to try to play some good notes, which is actually at the core of everything for me, in addition to this more expansive way of looking at the instrument.
Well, I think maybe we should listen to an example, and there are so many to choose from, and they range rather widely. Do you mind if I select one, or would you rather?
Anything.
There's something here I actually kind of wondered. It's labeled When We Were Free, but I'm wondering if it might be Montevideo instead. Because do you know if that might have happened on the album, or do you think
that's possible?
It's
one are you trying to? Which one are you shooting for?
Let's see. It's by this. I just enjoy the sound of it. And it's track three. Let me see. What did I?
Track three is Montevideo.
Okay. Okay. So that's what it says. But the one title, When We Were Free, I expected it to sound a little more freeform, and track three was more freeform. So I wondered if they had been switched around. But I think I'm just imagining.
Titles are a tough nut to crack for me.
Yeah.
The fact that there's any title on any record is kind of a miracle in itself, to tell you the truth. It's really the hardest part of the whole deal.
Yeah, there's plenty of jazz tunes called Untitled, for example, or Untitled spelled backwards or some, you know, silly thing like that. Anyway, well then, I'll call it what you've called it here, When We Were Free. And it's, of course, you with Lyle Mays, Steve Rodby, and Paul Wertico on guitar, piano, bass, and drums, When We Were Free. Thank you. see, we even got it moving on to that track that that's why I thought there might be a confusion on the name. And it does happen. Albums get misnamed from time to time. So thanks for straightening me out on that. And again, we're talking with Pat Metheny, who's performing with the Whitworth Jazz Ensemble tomorrow night at the Fox, right?
Yep.
And Dan Keberly's here, too, if you want to...
Yeah, hi.
You want to say something, too, about the concert tomorrow?
Well, I know that Pat has you know, fans all over the world, and
true,
including here, and I'm expecting a lot of people. I mean, it's going to probably be, you know, really full. So just if you want to get a seat near the front, you ought to get there a little bit early. I think the doors open at 7.
Right, for 8 o'clock downbeat.
8 o'clock show, yeah. But, I mean, it's been, we've been doing this 27 years. We've been bringing in different jazz artists, and many of them are at the top, you know, big name people, and we always have a decent crowd. But the response that we've had, because Pat Metheny's coming, has been mm-hmm. like none of the other ones.
Yeah.
You know, you have fans in all over, in every style and every part of the world. It's really remarkable. And the other thing, I'll probably say this when I introduce you at the show, but my college students have been saying, when are we going to have Pat Metheny? They've been saying that for about 25 years, too. And I always would try. I mean, you don't know that, but I've called many times, and you're always on the road. You're just always gone, and so we're thrilled that it finally worked out.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Steve said he'd been to Japan, Steve Rodby, often a bass player and sometimes a producer, said he'd been to Japan with you 13 times. I don't know if he was exaggerating or remembering that wrong, but that's like, wow, that's just
it's
amazing.
It's at least that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, you're not going to hear any complaints from the guitar department. I've been very lucky over, you know, now 45 years.
It's really, really remarkable.
To get to play with great musicians in many, many different settings.
Do you mind talking a little bit about some of the earlier folks that encouraged you early on, like Gary Burton and Herbie Hancock?
Sure. Maybe those are the two biggest ones, actually. Gary, besides everything else, his band of the late 60s, the Gary Burton Quartet.
Yeah, which just hit us like a lightning bolt.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, people, you know, historically kind of now talk a lot about Bitches Brew, the Miles Davis record of the early 70s, which as a sort of transition and important record, which it certainly was in a certain way. But, I mean, you know, Gary's thing predates that by 3-4 years in terms of trying to really reconcile, you know, what was happening in the culture at large, including, you know, pop and rock type playing with this sort of larger tradition. And for that reason, his band was just a sort of super important group for me. This would have been the quartet with Roy Haynes and Steve Swallow and Larry Coryell. And that was like the Beatles for me. That was my favorite band. I loved all kinds of music, but that was the band for me. That was it.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I had never done anything else other than being in that band, I would have been the happiest person on the planet, because it was sort of like getting to join the Beatles at age 18 for me when I got that gig. So
well, that was really beautiful music. I mean, Gary Burton's sensibility and sound
and Gary
feel.
Remains kind of a model for me. I mean, you know, there are certainly lots of talented people that I've known and that I've played with, and yet at the same time, you know, I'm very happy to say Gary and I have continued a significant playing connection over all these years. I mean, it's not constant, but we get together every 10 years or so and do a thing. And it's, you know, whenever I need a reminder of how great really is, getting on the bandstand with him is always that. Because it's not just that he's a great musician. It's that he came up with, and back to something we were talking about before, conceptually, he invented a way of thinking about music and a way of improvising that was absolutely uniquely his own. I mean, he invented a way of playing his instrument that had just not really been addressed before.
Didn't sound like anybody else.
And he also plays consistently great constantly. He just never drops below a certain level. So for me, having him as a sort of like literal model by being in his band for 4 years and having to play solos after he would play was probably the best thing that could have ever happened.
Yeah.
Herbie Hancock, if I have to say, who, if somebody says, who's your favorite musician, it's probably Herbie.
Wow.
And, you know, there's many reasons for that, but there's the, I mean, to me, there's just a few musicians that sort of everybody agrees on, and Herbie's kind of one of them. Well, Stevie Wonder maybe is another one where it's like,
for
you
me,
know,
yeah.
everybody loves Herbie, mm-hmm. and there's and that universal quality that he has. And yet, at the same time, in Herbie's case, and this is true with Stevie Wonder too, you can also look at it under an electron, a musical electron microscope, and find, you know, little pockets of genius all mm-hmm. the way down to the mm-hmm. electron level,
mm-hmm.
as well as you can just put it on and it'll make mm-hmm. the wallpaper in your room turn purple or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I met Herbie when I was 15 in Kansas City. He came
nice.
To hear me play,
wow.
and
uh-huh.
and you know, we've played together a lot over the years here and there, and he's just another real important person for me.
Mm. Very, very cool. That's really a wonderful thing. Gary Burton has always encouraged young people in his band and is still doing that. Every most recent album I've got, there he is doing it again with people a third of his age, you know, playing with him. And do you try to emulate that part? Do you try to encourage young kids to play with you? And there's other ways of doing it, you know. I mean, you're doing it tomorrow.
I've always been the beneficiary of that.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I do feel a kind of commitment to knowing what is happening with younger cats. And, you know, I do live in New York. I am very aware of who's playing what and who's playing with who and, you know, who's the new force doing this and doing that. And there are moments along the way where there's an opportunity for me where I hear somebody where I instantly get a picture in my mind of what I might be able to offer that person. You know, most recently it's been, you know, in the context of this Unity thing that mm-hmm. When we were here last time, a great young bass player joined us, Ben Williams, mm-hmm. who at the time was in his mid-20s. You know, I really looked at every bass player in New York, old and young, and kind of landed on Ben because I felt like he would bring something unique. And at the same time, there were things about what he was playing and the way he was playing. I thought, you know, I could probably offer some suggestions. And I think that's, you know, whenever you have that kind of symbiotic connection with a musician in any way, it's always worth pursuing. You know, in my case, it's now pretty interesting. I'm 61. You know, I started out, as I mentioned before, we're joining these kind of international level type bands. I was 18, 19 years old. So I've kind of been on both sides of the equation. The truth is, when you're playing, it sort of doesn't really matter that much, like how old anybody is, mm-hmm. because as soon as somebody
sure.
goes one, two,
sure.
one, two, three,
that's
four,
right.
you're kind of on your own,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm going to play in March with Roy Haynes for his 91st birthday. And I played on his 90th birthday last year. And, you know, when Roy sits there, he transforms into a 13-year-old. And
yeah.
What you see is something that I think all musicians relate to, which is he's just trying to sound good.
Sure.
He's
sure.
like, okay, you know, here I am, and you hear him, like, you know, adjusting his bass drum and, you know, wow. adjusting his touch, and, you know, he's the same. And I feel like I'm kind of the same, too. It's like I just kind of want to get better, and I want to improve when it's time to play on that weird set of changes. I wish I could do that better, and, you know, sometimes I wish I was doing a little more of this and a little less of that. I see that in Roy too, and Sonny Rollins too is another great musician I've had the chance to play with a fair amount, and I just kind of notice he's just trying to sound good. He's working on his stuff, you know, and that seems to be kind of a universal thing that transcends any of the age stuff.
Yeah. Well, I love it. I love all those thoughts. I think you're just onto a lot of good stuff. Let's play one more before we go our different ways, which I know we always need to do. I wonder which one was the one Oh, yeah, he plays bass clarinet on one of these. I like that, too. But I was going to say Then and Now, which I really like, but let's go with Then and Now. But it's you of course, with Chris Potter on tenor sax and bass clarinet and soprano, Ben Williams on bass, and Antonio Sanchez on drums. Then and Now from the Unity Band. I guess that's just the name of the album, Unity Band, right? Okay.
Great.
We'll be back in a moment. Thank you.
Now and then.
Yeah.
Then and now.
Then and now. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, we've been chatting, and I set down the CD, and I go, oh, what was that? And that was from the Unity Band. So that's, anyway, a lot of fun listening to this music and talking about music, of course, two of my very favorite things. But thank you so much for coming up. Let's talk again briefly about the concert. That's tomorrow night at 8 at the Fox, and Pat Metheny with the Whitworth Jazz Ensemble. And before leaving, I wanted to touch on the Orchestrion project. And I just thought that was a very interesting and quirky thing. And it's another part of what makes up you. And it's why it's kind of a weird picture when you look at the whole big thing. But talk about the Orchestrion project a little.
It's, you know, all kind of came out of this fascination I had as a little kid with the player piano that was in my grandfather's basement that was this kind of odd combination of, like, Jules Verne and science fiction to me. Mm-hmm. It just seemed impossible that something like that could exist, and at the same time it was kind of stinky and smelled old and everything else, and I would spend, you know, kind of my whole visit with them underneath this thing trying to figure out what was going on. And It struck me that it was a fantastic, you know, sonic environment that really had not been explored that much, and it really was kind of abandoned upon the development of recorded sound. I mean, you know, making records and being able to make wire recordings of sound trumped the idea of having this huge mechanical device
play music,
playing notes. Right. So. You know, those instruments went away pretty quickly, and at the same time, you know, I retain an interest in them throughout. And when the disc clavier came out, which was an instrument that most people are familiar with from performances of Girl from Ipanema in various hotel lobbies around the world by a unmanned baby grand piano, usually way out of tune. That instrument was something very distinctly different from what a player piano was in the sense that it used robotic solenoids as opposed to pneumatic pump type scrolling devices. And that sort of piqued my interest, like, okay, well, why hasn't this really been looked at through the prism of a particular musician's identity? And why does it have to be just piano? Why couldn't it be all kinds of things? And I sort of started paying attention, this would have been in the 90s, to who was doing what in this realm in terms of inventors and you know, wacky dudes out there in their garages building various new kinds of instruments. And I finally kind of collected a number of instruments made by a number of different people, none of whom really were even that aware of each other, and decided that I would try to see if I could reconcile my thing with some of the potentials of these instruments. And as I often say, had there been any remaining doubt about exactly how weird I am prior to that project put it to rest once and for all. It was a very unusual way to present music. The tour that followed the release of that record was fascinating for me, and one of the best parts was to just, I wish I had taken pictures of the audience each night. I mean, at this point, it's a little bit of a known thing because I did it, but at the time when the record first came out and I was out on the road, nobody really knew exactly what was going to happen or what I was even talking about.
What's the range of some of the sound producing instruments involved?
Well, there were about 300 devices on stage. you know, by that I mean individual voices of different types. And there was, you know, a lot of percussion instruments, cymbals, you know, things that you could connect to a drum set, although they were happening sort of as individual entities. Two disc claviers, vibes, marimba, various other mallet instruments, xylophone, a couple different orchestra bells. There were these wacky kind of guitar bot things that this guy made, Eric Singer, who's really one of the leading figures in new instrument development. Couple different guitars made by the guy who does, you know, stuff for Disney. I mean, it was a very wide range of stuff. And honestly, I feel like I barely scratched the surface of it. I'm looking forward to doing it again, maybe 2020, 2021. I'm already kind of researching new things. And now that I've been out there doing it, I've met the other seven wacky dudes on the planet sure. that build instruments like that. So, I've lived on the kind of bleeding edge of technology by way of electronics, meaning synths and that sort of thing, for 35 years. Sure. And I love that stuff, but synths and electric guitar, I mean, you're basically talking about speakers, same with electric bass and so forth. To me, speakers are somewhat speakery. I mean, a speaker is a speaker, and it doesn't matter if you're using a 64-bit synth or this, that, or listening to a stereo. The speaker is the activating voice in the room. The thing about what I was going for with the Orchestrion is that it is not speaker-based music. It's acoustic-based music that uses the possibility of what the 21st century offers us in terms of control of music, but with an acoustic output. And this is a little bit lost on the record. I mean, a lot of people, when they hear the record,
because you're still hearing it through speakers.
You know, it just sounds like whatever
it sounds
like.
Because the record's played on a speaker.
Because the record is on a speaker, exactly. So, you know, it was one of those things, like, unless you experienced it live, you kind of almost wouldn't even get it. And I do recommend for anybody who's interested to get the DVD that we made at the end of the tour, where you really can see not only what I was doing with it, but also the range of things. I mean, I could also create pieces completely on the fly, completely improvised pieces using all of this orchestration, which was really fun. And at the same time, I could also have things that were very written. And there's no reason why those two things could not coexist as well. So on a compositional, improvisational level, it was also a fascinating experience.
Well, I'm very glad I asked, and it turns out you have some very interesting motivations for doing that, and I think that really does help flesh out the story. So I almost didn't ask because I knew it was going to be a bit of a left turn, but that was a lot of fun. So
cool.
So thank you for explaining it, and thank you so much for coming up and talking with me.
It's
been a real delight. So I hope you all have a wonderful time at that concert tomorrow again at the Fox with the Whitworth Jazz Ensemble and Dan Gaberly directing, and thanks, Dan, for bringing Pat Metheny.
My
this
pleasure.
Is going to be fun for all of us.
Oh, yeah.
So thank you very much.
Great to be here.